With our special guest tonight, Dr. Richard Sodders, we talk about underground bases. Just incredible information. We're going to get into the particulars, have him illustrate just what it might, what they might look like, how many people are down there, and what are they doing. And we'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, about, just on the average, how many people do you think are in each base, each underground base?
You know, George, I almost can't answer that question. The simple answer is I don't know. What I can tell you is that, and at full occupancy, some of these bases certainly can hold a couple of thousand people, maybe even much more. That I can tell you from the open literature. The smaller facilities at any one time might just have a handful of personnel in them, but the larger ones, like Mount Weather or Site R or Cheyenne Mountain in its heyday, other ones like that of similar size and importance might have had hundreds at any time. So they can be quite large and sophisticated, really like small towns deep underground. So I hope that'll give you some idea. Now, as to the total number of personnel underground, I have actually posed that question to people that I have interviewed over the years, and no one can really say, and here's why. Because of the extreme compartmentalization in this country and in other countries right around the world, there's no way of knowing. Even if, say, you work for the Navy or the Air Force or the Army might not even know what the Navy is doing, and the Navy may not know completely what the Air Force is doing, and they all might have questions about what the Department of Energy is doing or the NSA, and vice versa. So great is the compartmentalization. They may not even fully be aware of all of the other underground facilities that various military agencies and government agencies have, what to speak of the corporate agencies and other organizations such as religious orders or fraternal organizations and that type of thing. So it's virtually an impossible question to answer. It varies from base to base, facility to facility.
Richard, if you had to paint a picture, what do they look like down there, these places?
Which, you mean the people or the installations?
The installations. And we'll get into the ETs a little later, but the installations themselves, what do you think they look like? I mean, they're kitchens, they have bunks, rooms.
Well, some of
like
them, earlier on, my understanding is a lot of them were comparatively rustic and Spartan in that, yes, they had bunks and communal dining areas and that type of thing. But now the new generation of these facilities are really very sophisticated with a fair number of creature comforts so that it's not exactly like living topside because you're underground, but my understanding is it's like living in a multi-level building that you might experience in your everyday life, an apartment building or a office building or a corporate headquarters or something like that, with the exception that it's underground. Now, of course, some of these facilities have cavernous areas. I mean, some of the things that I've read and been told about some of the chambers and rooms, so-called rooms that exist in these subterranean facilities, they're vast. I mean, they can be hundreds of feet tall, hundreds of feet wide. I was one time in a conversation with one of my sources, and I asked him, how large can these underground spaces be, the open spaces in these underground bases? And he gave me an illustration of a mine here in the lower 48 that over the years was excavated such that when it was finished, if I understood him correctly, there was an interior space that was about 600 feet wide, 1,100 feet long, and about 1,100 feet or 1,000 feet tall.
That's pretty big.
Yeah. Now, the intention originally was not to just make a big space underground. But it so happened as the miners removed and excavated the ore, the mother load, as it were, that eventually they were left with this huge, vast chamber as they removed that. And then the mine is no longer a working mine. But he illustrated his answer that way. In other words, simply by using conventional mining technology, you can make a huge underground space that you wouldn't know about viewing a mountain or the countryside from the surface. And so by implication, what he was telling me was, Richard, you can make huge, huge facilities underground, and you can't tell it just from walking by or driving by on the surface.
What is the Nazi connection, the Nazi angle to some of this, Richard?
Yeah, this always comes up. You know, you can see on the History Channel and other shows on television,
yeah,
and even in movies sometimes, this idea of the underground workings and bases that the Nazis built back in the 30s and 40s. And, you know, the Nazis had an organization, an agency called the Todt Organization, originally run by Fritz Todt, who was the German engineer who developed the Autobahn system of freeways, which exists to this day. It was very well done. And Fritz Todt was really a genius, a very gifted civil engineer. Well, during World War II, he was tapped to form an organization called the Todt Organization, which was more or less an analog in the Nazi system to what the Army Corps of Engineers would be in the American military system. And during World War II, the Todt Organization carried out extensive construction projects of all kinds for the Nazi military and for the SS. Now, that included making underground tunnels and underground factories and bases, some of them impressively large and sophisticated. There were the Regenwurmslager in what is now Poland, which was an extensive miles-long network of underground bases and tunnels with electric trains running through it, 150 feet underground, and also some very large underground industrial facilities for making aircraft and missiles and so forth. Now, Fritz Todt was killed during World War II in a plane crash, and a man named Xaver Dorsch took his place and was put in charge of the organization and held that position until war's end. Now, at the end of the war, I have documentation in my possession that shows that Xaver Dorsch was taken into custody by the American military occupation force and was extensively debriefed over about a two-year period. I have a couple of documents that he wrote for them, and essentially the Americans decided they were going to do what the Nazis did, and I also have a Project Paperclip memo seeking to bring Xaver Dorsch and some of the other Nazi engineers with expertise in that field to the United States to help create a so-called underground plant program for the United States military. Now, I don't know if Xaver Dorsch ever came to the United States, but he certainly was extensively debriefed by the U.S. Army, and they got his engineering knowledge in that fashion at the very least. But right after World War II, there was an explosion, if you will, of underground construction activity in this country by the military-industrial complex, and it has not ceased to this day. Now, I want to say also in that regard that there was that impetus from the Nazi military-industrial complex. But there was also, at the same time, another engineer in Germany named Hermann Kemper. And Hermann Kemper, during the Nazi period, had an invention that he was doing the research and design work on called the Rohrbahn. Now, the Rohrbahn was an underground high-speed magnetic levitation, so-called maglev tube shuttle train,
mm-hmm,
that was designed to travel through vacuum tubes, tunnels from which the air had been evacuated at very high speed. Hermann Kemper envisioned this network of high-speed maglev tunnel trains beneath Europe, traveling at speeds up to 1,200 miles per hour. Now, he developed these plans back in the 1930s and worked on this all up through World War II and continued his research after World War II. And today, this research still goes on in Germany. In fact, the Germans are leading the world in maglev train technology, and just a few years ago installed a state-of-the-art maglev train in China. So it's the Chinese and the Germans that are leading the pack now, and the Germans never stopped this research. They just continued with it down to the years. Now, of course, the question is, was this research brought over to the United States secretly? Because we have many rumors of just such a deep underground, high-speed maglev tube train system in this country, and that those stories have been around for the last 20 or 25 years anyway. So I wonder if when the Americans went into into Germany after the war, if they didn't just snatch up a lot of those plans and research and design blueprints and bring them back along with Wernher von Braun and a lot of engineers and some other engineers.
Can you mention some of the states that you're sure have underground bases?
Oh, right off the top of my head,
yeah,
California for sure.
Okay.
Texas for sure. Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania.
Indiana, because people talk about a hum near Kokomo.
Well, you know, I would say yes in Indiana. Let me tell you that the Midwest is dotted with huge underground caverns that were built by Phoenix and Sisson in past years and decades. And when I say they're huge, I mean they're gargantuan, George. And there are just scores and scores of these all across the Midwest, because the geology in much of the Midwest is very favorable for underground construction. And some of these are in Indiana as well. Now, let me say that Phoenix and Sisson, having built these, could turn them over to virtually anyone or sell them to virtually anyone for use for virtually anything.
Okay, you just mentioned geology. California, New Madrid Fault in the Midwest, down toward the south. What about
earthquakes? Doesn't matter much. And there are other states that have underground installations. New Mexico, for example, does. Colorado does. And Nevada, of course. So many states in this country have underground installations. Georgia has underground installations. On and on. So they're quite common. There are many of them. And these are just ones I know, states I know have installations. There are others, Massachusetts, that have them. I just know these off the top of my head. Now, there certainly are others that I don't know about, so they're quite common, George.
Richard, let's get into the ET angle for just a moment. Do you think, let's say under Area 51, we can claim that's an underground base.
It is.
Are they storing craft down there?
I think they are.
And ETs themselves, extraterrestrials, are they there?
Yeah, I don't know if ETs themselves are there, but I've seen and heard enough that I do believe that there are some alien craft at so-called Area 51, and I believe also at other places. I think they would have them other places, they meaning the military-industrial espionage complex, meaning CIA, NSA, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and then the major Pentagon contractors like Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, et cetera. These types of companies are very heavily into the black budget world, black
sure.
compartmentalized projects. So they would be involved at these facilities also. But, yes, I think they do have them there and at White Sands and some other places as well.
What about alien underground bases that the aliens constructed?
I think they exist. Let me tell you, my answer is a little bit more nuanced than that, George.
All right.
And, of course, this is a burning question you see discussed on television programs, hinted at in movies, or actually shown in what have you in fictional form. But yes, I think there are alien bases. There may even be a lot of them. And I believe in some cases they've been here for many, many thousands of years, going way, way back. Now, I also think that in some cases, because there's so much anecdotal evidence of this now, that there probably is a joint presence on the part of clandestine elements of the United States power structure. Let's put it that way, corporate, military, and civil, and that there is joint occupancy or joint tenancy with so-called extraterrestrial alien beings. Now, not all of these aliens are so-called little grays or reptilians. Some of them are human beings that look just like us. In other words, the Earth evidently is not the only planet in the galaxy with a resident human population. It appears that the human race, with minor differences from planet to planet, may be very widespread in this galaxy.
We may be, you know, we may be seeded.
We may be seated, or we may be quarantined. I think it was about 25 years ago where I was in conversation with someone, and he mentioned to me the fact that the Earth was a prison planet. Now, that was the first time that anyone had ever broached that topic with me in any way, but instantly I recognized that that's probably the case. And in some sense, we are a prison planet. We are locked down, and in fact, our societies are very controlled, including right here in the United States. You know that the very well-known German philosopher and writer, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, observed a couple hundred years ago that no man is more thoroughly enslaved than the one who falsely believes himself to be free.
True. So true.
And I just described hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people on this planet. In the United States, we assume that we're free, but we have pervasive surveillance by the NSA and the CIA and Homeland Security. We go to the airport, we take off our belt and our shoes, we empty our pockets, we have people question us, interrogate us, we're wanded, we're scanned. On and on, we're constantly having to show our identity papers, i.e. our driver's license or social security card for this, that, and the other thing. We're as controlled as a herd of cattle, George.
In your book, Underground Bases and Tunnels, What the Government is Trying to Hide, when you were researching it, Richard, was there anything that you stumbled across that startled you in terms of information?
Yeah, I would say yes, sir. The first thing that startled me was that I could find out so much information. Having just said that we live in a controlled society, it's a controlled society where bureaucracies generate a lot of paper that they assume no one will read. And in fact, most people don't ever read any of it. No one goes to these research, these document collections and so forth. I was startled, and this is the second thing that startled me. Number one, that the documents were there, but number two, that no one read them. I could go in the federal documents collections for hours and hours and hours, and sometimes not see another person for 3 or 4 hours on end because no one else would come into the stacks. And not only that, but I would pull a document off the shelf of 1950s vintage maybe, and I could see that in some cases, no one in half a century had checked out that document from the library, that I was the first one. So that was the second thing that startled me.
And we'll get back to more, too. Plus, we'll talk about what you believe could be a secret space program, backing up what Richard C. Hoagland has always believed. Well, we've entered the iPhone app with Streamlink. And for those of you who just like to have some fun and play some alien games and things like that, it's a great source of information. You can get that information by going to coasttocoastam.com. And by the way, if you're not a member of Streamlink, for just pennies a day, you can do that and also download now the past 2 years of programs. And that's something. We're working on year number 3 right now as well. Back in a moment with Dr. Richard Sauter on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, before we get into what could be the secret space program, we're talking about some of the things that you uncovered in your book, and you were mentioning a couple points, and then the clock goddess. You want to continue? Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the other things that surprised me was that a lot of people actually have knowledge of what's going on underground. Because the operations are so extensive, it can't be totally hidden, and a lot of this stuff is, so to speak, hidden in plain sight. And if you know what you're looking at, you can discover a surprising amount of information. And I was pleasantly surprised to discover that a lot of people do have bits and pieces of this puzzle. And it's been very encouraging to me and helpful to me over the years to have people communicate what they know to me. So that was a pleasant surprise. And not surprising, given that so much money is involved. So many years have gone by. This has been going on for 50 or 60 or more years now. So many agencies are involved. There's technology involved. The sheer number of facilities. It really couldn't be otherwise. But it just goes to show that maybe we're our own best ally when push comes to shove, and that if we're going to, so to speak, reclaim not just North America or our society, but our planet, that it'll be a group effort with cooperation, one with the other, by exchanging information, by helping each other, and by having a spirit of mutual help, if you will.
The equipment that they use to build these bases, are we using it here now on the surface?
Well, underground, the actual machines that are used to build the tunnels, for example, the so-called tunnel boring machines, are in routine use in the mining industry and also in civil engineering for making tunnels of every variety and description. And they're also used on the clandestine or compartmentalized black projects. Now, I'm assuming there's also more exotic technology in use. That technology, no, I don't think would be openly used in the everyday world that George Noory or Richard Sauter might circulate in. But some of it certainly is, whether we're talking about structural steel or reinforced concrete, tunnel boring machines, front end loaders, or so forth. A lot of the equipment that is used topside would also be used underground to do similar things.
The secret space program. Of course, Richard Hoagland believes it's going on, and I'm beginning to think you believe it's going on as well.
Sure, I do.
And the technology that has been used to build these underground bases on this planet. Is it possible that they have these bases on the moon, for example?
Well, you know, I think it is. And if you'd asked me that, you know, 30 years ago, I would have just not known what to say. I might have thought you were touched in the head. Now, even then, there may have been such facilities on the moon, in my opinion. Now, I think that the manned space program, in fact, could have begun in the early 1950s and been underway already 10 years and maybe more by the time NASA very publicly put up the first astronauts, Gus Grissom, John Glenn, Alan Shepard, so forth, that there are other technologies that evidently have been kicking around in the black world, such as anti-grav lifts and that type of thing, and that they have been held back from us. But, yes, in my underground bases research, I have found numerous documents now with a provenance going all the way back to the 60s and extending right up to the 90s of a variety of agencies and think tanks talking about building bases on the moon and or building tunnel networks on the moon, and seriously. And I've run across enough of these reports now that I'm starting to think maybe the reason this is being discussed in the open literature is because it's really being done. And that the expectation is that sooner or later it'll break out into the public. And so in order to, you know, lay the engineering and scientific groundwork, so to speak, there are these conference papers and technical documents that are in the open literature. It occurs to me to ask that question because one of the men, in fact, the lead engineer on the R&D effort for the so-called nuclear tunneling machine, the subterranean tunneling machine,
yeah,
that was designed and developed, at least in concept, at Los Alamos during the late 60s to early 80s, this man's name is John Rowley, R-O-W-L-E-Y, and I'm satisfied the technology works, and I think he is too. The idea is that you take a SP100 fission reactor and you circulate liquid lithium that you heat to about 2,000 degrees through the cutting face of a tunneling machine, and it slices through solid rock like a hot knife through butter. Well, he did the R&D work for this at Los Alamos, but he's spoken very openly about using this machine to make a tunnel system on the moon. And in fact, he wrote a paper in 1985 entitled "In Situ Rock Melting Applied to Lunar Base Construction and for Exploration Drilling and Coring on the Moon." And he actually includes in the paper the diagrams of full-sized nuclear-powered tunneling machines. So, you know, this is the kind of thing I have found in open literature again and again. I'm starting to think that maybe it has been done. Of course, we don't have a machine that will carry a huge, a space vehicle, at least openly,
right,
that will carry a huge tunnel boring machine from Earth to the moon. So he evidently thinks it can be taken up there. But, George, I don't think so, not with chemical rockets.
No,
because
that's
these things weigh hundreds of tons.
Unless we've developed a form of levitation or anti-gravity device.
Well, and there's, you know, a fair amount of evidence that suggests that's the case. One of the things, and this is getting back to the surprises that you asked me to talk about, that I stumbled across in my research. When I started going through the technical literature, I started all the way back in the 40s. I went way back. And one of the things that I noticed was that there were references to anti-gravity research on the part of government agencies and research facilities and institutes. But it all dried up in a time period of say, the mid-50s to early 60s. It all went bye-bye. And the thought that occurred to me at the time was, no, it didn't go away. It just went black. It went into the classified world, into the top secret realm, because I'm not an engineer, but I know enough about basic science and engineering that it seemed to me, just from the reading of the titles of the reports that I was seeing referenced, that some breakthrough was made, and I suspect enough of a breakthrough that the decision was made to take this black, like at Area 51 or White Sands or facilities like that, and develop it for the secret use of the military-industrial complex and to use it for their own purposes. And there's some evidence to suggest that that may have occurred. In fact, Nick Pope wrote his famous book, The Hunt for Zero Point, and I suspect you've interviewed Nick Cook, rather,
a
time or two.
Why the cloak of secrecy, Richard? Why do they need to hide
free energy? Free energy, or at least energy that is a lot freer. When you have a whole species, 6.5 billion strong, who can unplug from Shell Oil, from Marathon Oil, you follow me, from Texaco.
I'm with you.
All of a sudden, the whole petrochemical complex takes a dive. And they're left high and dry. When you don't have to pay thousands of dollars for gasoline, for heating oil, for natural gas, for electricity, that's economically extremely freeing. It also would effectively put an end to the nuclear industry. So you're talking about huge multi-billion-dollar industries that would go bye-bye real fast. In other words, it would rework the entire industrial, economic, and political structure of this planet. And that's why.
Do you remember when there was construction, underground construction going on at Vice President Dick Cheney's house, and neighbors went nuts because they were so loud?
In fact, I talked to a lady that lives in the neighborhood there, and she wasn't happy about it. She said that, by the way, it was the United States Navy doing that, because the vice president's official residence is on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Northwest Washington, D.C. Anyway, I talked to one of the ladies that is a local resident there in that neighborhood, and she said it really annoyed people there because they were doing blasting. They were setting off explosives.
Yeah.
And it was rattling people's houses, shaking their foundations. I think some people may have had broken windows and smashed china even from that. So the locals weren't happy about it. And she said they put up, they being the Navy put up a huge tarp to block the construction activity from public view so that people driving by on the street or walking their dog down the sidewalk couldn't see what was going on. But it went on and on and on. It wasn't just a weekend remodeling project.
Did the mainstream media ever question him at any news?
Well, not directly, no. You know, the mainstream news media in this country are domesticated, man. They're just let me use the word pathetic. Independent journalism or investigative journalism is virtually extinct in this country. We have a corporate media now who are just, it's a yes chorus, a chorus of yes men and yes women who don't ask probing questions, with very rare exceptions. So the Washington Post did do a couple of stories about it, but they didn't probe very deeply. The Washington Post is it's a company rag, George, you know that.
Yeah. Well, the L.A. Times back about a year ago said that Cheney's house was off limits to Google Earth. That it was blurred. Google blurred the images of the house, so you really couldn't see what was going on from above.
Well, you know, it may be, but I don't. There again with Google, Google Earth blurred it, but certainly the Russian satellites were not blurring it. The Chinese satellites were not blurring it. Indian satellites weren't blurring it. Israeli satellites weren't blurring it. French satellites weren't blurring it. The only people in the dark, George, are the public in the United States, the intelligence agencies of other countries and the military agencies of other countries had a perfect view of everything. It's only we, the sheeple, who don't know, who are kept in the dark by design. So in reality, all this secrecy is designed to keep us ignorant because Chinese and Russians know exactly what's going on. It's us.
Thousands
we don't know what's going on.
Thousands of people disappear in this country alone every year. Thousands of people. They're just gone.
Large numbers.
How do we know that they're not being yanked down in these tunnels for some reason?
I don't know, George. You know, this issue comes up over and over and over. I've seen it raised by many people. It's what I can tell you is that I've looked into it. In fact, I discussed this question with Don Ecker of UFO Magazine. You may know Don and his wife, Vicky. And what, you know, Don, before he got into ufology years ago, was a policeman, actually, an investigator, a detective who worked for a department in the New York City metropolitan area. And this was something he noticed in the course of his police work, and he collected data from all of the police agencies in the New York metropolitan area, put them together, and came up with a very large number that deeply troubled him. So he went to the FBI, if I remember correctly, and the FBI was not responsive. I won't say they were non-responsive, but they were not very responsive. But he was left with the sobering conclusion that a lot of people are disappearing and not all of the disappearances can be explained by murder or by parents running away with a child in a custody dispute, for example. Some disappearances certainly can be explained in those ways. In fact, many of them can, but not all of them. And at the end of the day, he was left with a large number that deeply troubled him. Now, I've looked into some of this data as well, and I've reached the same conclusion. A lot of people run away. A lot of people go missing, and as time goes by, either their bodies are found or they resurface somewhere else or they resurface with a child in a custody dispute. But taking all of that into account, yes, a surprising number of people vanish in this country every year, never to be heard from again, and they're of both genders, of all ages, and of all ethnicities. So it's across the board. It's not just so-called milk carton kids. It's, the problem is much larger than that. I suspect that some of them could be taken into underground facilities because going back years now, I keep hearing stories about underground genetic engineering and cloning and so forth. And the issue of human guinea pigs arises. You may remember the Krista Tilton story from years ago from the 1980s. And I don't know if you've ever interviewed Krista, have you?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I've talked to her two or three times now, and she and others saw troubling things underground, what appeared to be people being cloned and other things, which very much raises this kind of issue. And if that's the case, then we have a very dark reality taking place beneath our feet, a Nazi type of reality when you get right down to it. And I have to say, I directly asked this question to one of my well-informed sources several years ago, and the response I got from this man was that any people that were used for that type of research or experimentation underground would not be likely to be released alive, but would be dispatched of underground and disposed underground. That was his response.
Who started all of this, Richard? Whose idea was it to build these tunnels and these bases?
You know, I think it goes way back into the mists of prehistory, George.
Yeah, could be.
I think it goes back at least to the time of the Egyptians. And by the way, the Egyptians did a lot of underground work. There are a lot of tunnels under Giza and elsewhere in Egypt.
They've only scratched the surface, I bet.
Yes, there's quite a lot underground in Egypt. I've been there a couple of times, and I've seen enough just from what I observed as a more informed tourist than most by far. I can say the ancient Egyptians did a lot of underground tunneling, digging, construction, and excavation. And what you see when you go to Giza and other ancient archaeological sites in Egypt is a fraction of what's there because there's a lot beneath the surface. But I think it goes back even further than that to Atlantean times. And yes, I accept that there was at least a previous round of high or sophisticated civilization on this planet, perhaps several cycles going way back tens and hundreds of thousands of years. I accept that. And I think that's a conclusion a lot of other cutting-edge researchers are coming to. There have been some books written in that vein in recent years, and quite good ones, I might add, by authors whom I believe you have interviewed.
Fascinating work with Richard Sauter. We'll be back with him and your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.